Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 29th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, in the foreground, we have Vladimir Putin, and he's standing next to Joseph Stalin. They've got their arms draped around each other's shoulders, and both have big smiles. The background, it's a blue sky. We can see the Kremlin off in the distance, and not far behind the two gentlemen is a policeman in riot gear, and he's got a billy club, and he's pounding on a civilian who looks distressed. The headline is, In Stalin's Footsteps, How Putin Became Dictator for Life. That is our second main story this morning, and we'll read that, but we'll start with the furor over Trump's bloodbath warning. What happened? Donald Trump and his allies pushed back this week against an uproar over his claim, if he's not reelected, there's going to be a bloodbath for the country. At a campaign appearance in Ohio, Trump opened with tributes to MAGA supporters jailed for their role in the January 6 insurrection, calling them unbelievable patriots and hostages. He called migrants entering the U.S. criminals and animals who are not people, in my opinion. But the biggest reaction came in response to the bloodbath comment, which accompanied Trump's vow to put a 100% tariff on Chinese-made electric cars. Quote, Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. The Biden campaign accused Trump of doubling down on threats of political violence, and began airing an ad featuring the comment along with violent images of Trump supporters attacking the U.S. Capitol. But Trump and his campaign insisted he'd been talking about an economic bloodbath in the auto industry. Trump's former Vice President Mike Pence went on Fox News to announce he couldn't in good conscience endorse Trump. On January 6, Trump supporters called for Pence's death by hanging as they stormed the Capitol, and Trump reportedly told aides Pence deserved that fate for refusing to block certification of Joe Biden's electoral win. Pence cited January 6 as a reason for his decision, but also emphasized profound policy differences with Trump, whose positions are at odds with the conservative agenda. What the columnist said, Bloodbathgate is a farce, said Jeffrey Blehar in National Review. It's clear that Trump, playing to a working-class crowd in the Rust Belt, was amping up fears of economic doom. But the hyperventilating press turned his loose-tongued bloviation into a call for nationwide massacres. Every time the Trump-hating press overreacts, said Jonah Goldberg in the Dispatch, it enables Trump and his allies to dismiss legitimate warnings about his extremism as fake news, and cast Trump as a martyr. Trump can be artful in how he couches incitement, said Norman Eisen and Ruth Ben-Gate in MSNBC.com. He instinctively knows how to create a sense of existential fear in his audience and get people to overcome taboos about committing violence. It's what Trump did on January 6 when he told his followers, if you don't fight like hell, you won't have a country anymore. Let's look at the real context of the bloodbath warning, said Timothy Snyder in his Substack newsletter. Trump's rally started with a brazen celebration of the convicted criminals who beat cops and used an actual bloodbath to try to reverse the election results. Trump's pledge to pardon them was a clear signal that if he regains power, he'll protect anyone who commits violence on his behalf. His opponent, Trump said, is allied with subhuman animals who will destroy America. History tells us this is all straight from the fascist playbook. Those who ignore Trump's core message are the ones taking Trump's remarks out of context. In fact, Trump is making his defense of the January 6th insurrection a cornerstone of his bid to return to the White House, said Lisa Mascaro in the Associated Press. His rallies now often begin with a recording of January 6th prisoners singing the national anthem as Trump and his followers stand and salute. Meanwhile, he's calling for jailing former Representative Liz Cheney and other House committee members who investigated January 6th, and has installed a host of election deniers on the Republican National Committee. Trump is very clearly telling us he intends to end the rule of law and become an autocrat. Pence's refusal to endorse Trump is an act of patriotic heroism, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. No American vice president has ever said that the president he served under is unfit to serve. But Pence just did that. He's not alone. A host of former top Trump aides, including Defense Secretary Mark Esper and Chief of Staff John Kelly, have called their former boss a wannabe dictator and a threat to democracy. That should be the biggest story in American politics from here to November. And our second main story. Putin extends his one-man rule for another term. What happened? Russian President Vladimir Putin claimed victory this week in a predetermined election that will grant the country's longest-serving leader since Stalin another 6 years in power. The election board said he took 87% of the vote. Outside observers, though, estimated that millions of votes may have been faked. The Moscow-based election monitor Golos recorded more than 1,400 instances of ballot stuffing and other violations. Putin's name appeared on the ballot alongside three others, all relative unknowns handpicked by the Kremlin. The few true opposition candidates were barred from running, and Alexei Navalny, Putin's most powerful foe, died in a Siberian prison last month. Still, thousands of people went to the polls to vote against Putin in a noontime flash protest. In power, either as prime minister or president since 1999, Putin changed the constitution so he can run again after his new term expires in 2030. Chinese President Xi Jinping, who formed a No Limits partnership with Putin in 2022, called the election results a full demonstration of the support of the Russian people, while Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said he looked forward to strengthening Delhi's special and privileged partnership with Moscow. In a break with tradition, many Western nations, including the U.S., did not extend congratulations to Putin, instead calling the vote a mockery of the democratic process. There was nothing free or fair about this election, said White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. What the columnist said. That was no election, said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic, but an elaborate piece of political theater. Authorities claimed turnout was 77%, but that dubious figure was inflated by polling station raffle prizes and employer requirements that workers vote. Russians are not enthusiastic about a regime that has sent hundreds of thousands of men to the meat grinder that is the Ukraine war, and that persecutes people for laying flowers on Navalny's grave. Yet, as a raw display of power, the re-election charade was a decided success, said Brian Michael Jenkins in The Hill. In his 24 years in office, Putin has accumulated more authority than any Soviet leader, save perhaps Stalin. He has labeled civil society groups foreign agents, outlawed protest, and arrested hundreds of political prisoners. Now he is reorganizing the country for perpetual warfare against the West, while the ties he has forged with India and China allow the Russian economy to resist the pinch of sanctions. Perhaps Putin's rule is safe for now, said Samantha Dibundin in The Guardian. He controls the media, feeding Russians a diet of propaganda extolling him, and he would likely have won even a fair election. Still, ahead of the election, hundreds of thousands of voters signed petitions to support banned opposition candidates, while on voting day, untold numbers wrote in Navalny or otherwise spoiled their ballots. It may take years for the rift in Russian society to weaken the regime appreciably, but the rift is there. Controversy of the week. Israel. Schumer's call for Netanyahu to be replaced. U.S.-Israeli relations were already on shaky ground, said Barak Ravid in Axios. But what Senator Chuck Schumer just did has landed like an earthquake. The highest-ranking Jewish politician in American history, Schumer has been the Democratic Party's most avid supporter of Israel. But in a blistering speech on the Senate floor last week, Schumer blamed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the immense civilian toll of Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, which has reached about 32,000 Palestinians killed, including 13,000 children, according to the Gazan Health Ministry. Schumer accused Netanyahu of allowing his political survival to take precedence over the best interests of Israel, criticized his opposition to a Palestinian state, and called for new elections to replace Netanyahu's right-wing coalition. Israeli reaction was swift and indignant. Netanyahu accused Schumer of treating Israel like a banana republic, reminding him that he was elected by Israeli voters. But President Biden backed Schumer up, saying he made a good speech that expressed concern shared by many Americans. Schumer has committed a betrayal of epic proportions, said the New York Post in an editorial. It is grotesque, as Senator Mitch McConnell put it, for an American politician to call for the ouster of an ally's elected leader, especially when that ally is fighting an enemy that celebrated its slaughter of 1,200 Israeli civilians. Schumer's primary concern is not Israel. It's the November election in the U.S., said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. His attack on Netanyahu was a calculated effort to appease the anti-Israel American left, more than 100,000 of whom voted uncommitted in Michigan's primary last month to protest Biden's support for Israel. These mostly young lefties could cost Biden re-election if they stay home in November. Schumer and Biden surely both know that no Palestinian state is possible until Hamas is defeated in Gaza, but they've chosen to use the unpopular Netanyahu as a scapegoat for their party's growing animosity toward Israel. Schumer wasn't speaking for the anti-Israel left, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. He was speaking to and for millions of traditionally pro-Israel Democrats, who have watched with mounting alarm and exasperation as Netanyahu's government has simply ignored U.S. pressure to minimize civilian suffering and death in Gaza. Netanyahu's outrage at Schumer meddling in Israeli politics is quite ironic, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. Netanyahu gave a GOP-sponsored address to Congress to try to sabotage then-President Obama's nuclear deal with Iran, and then openly aligned himself with ex-President Trump, who endorsed him. Schumer is sincerely devoted to Israel's well-being, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, and he's right about Netanyahu. The Israeli leader's ruthless counteroffensive in Gaza and outright rejection of any two-state solution is making people forget the horrors of October 7th. His belligerence is destroying Israel's international support, as an entire generation of global youth watch horrifying videos of starving Palestinian children on TikTok. Israel has an overriding interest in pursuing a two-state horizon, even if tremendous obstacles remain. Under Netanyahu, said Matthew Brzezinski in MSNBC.com, Israel is falling short of its humanitarian ideals. It is no longer seen by the world as David fighting the giant Goliath. It has become Goliath. As Schumer summed it up, Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah. Here's our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for staying active after a 103-year-old Italian woman was arrested at 1 a.m. for driving a car with an expired license. Giuseppina Molinari vowed to continue to drive. "I will buy myself a Vespa," she said. The local mayor says she deserves a medal rather than a fine. It's a good week for pancakes. After the warmest winter on record, lead sap to start flowing from sugar maples in Wisconsin more than a month early. Syrup producer Carl Martin advised industry colleagues to have your pails ready. It's a good week for Nordic life. After Finland, Denmark, Iceland, and Sweden got the four top rankings in the annual World Happiness Report, based on a survey of citizens. The U.S. hit an all-time low, tumbling to 23rd. But it was a bad week for Band-Aids. After Salisbury, Massachusetts, residents paid $565,000 to truck 14,000 tons of sand to protect their beachfront homes from the advancing sea, only to see it all washed away in 72 hours. "I don't know what the solution is," said resident Ron Jamet. It's a bad week for giveaways. After 18,500 bobblehead dolls of retired hockey star Jaromir Jagr were stolen en route to a Pittsburgh Penguins promotional night. Who's going to try to move 18,000 bobbleheads on the black market? An FBI spokesman wondered. Finally, it was a bad week for classic rock. After police in Minnesota responding to a report of an elderly male walking with a shotgun, came upon a man carrying a stick. The embarrassed suspect confessed he had been listening to music and using the stick to play air guitar. Here's a short and other news piece. Congress reaches a spending deal. Congressional leaders struck an agreement this week on a $1 trillion spending package to fund key government agencies through the fall. Democrats and Republicans argued over funding levels for the Department of Homeland Security, the Pentagon, and the State Department for days before reaching the agreement, which faced criticism from hard-right Republicans. House Freedom Caucus member Chip Roy, Republican from Texas, said the deal was drawn up by the leadership of both parties and dropped on the floor of the House with little input from members. "That's back to the old way of doing things," said Roy, "which I think is a mistake." The package needed to be passed by Congress and signed by the President by March 22nd, giving the House just days to meet the deadline. Moving into the best columns, we'll start with the terrible cost of isolationism. "Our world resembles the 1930s more than we might think," said Hal Brands. As in the run-up to World War II, belligerent authoritarian states are seeking expansive empires and forming alliances, while a major America First political faction in the U.S. is preaching isolationism. Russia and China are not fully equivalent to Hitler's Germany and Imperial Japan, but as that era demonstrated, the international order can collapse with devastating thoroughness and speed. China is conducting massive military buildup in pursuit of its goal of absorbing Taiwan and dominating East Asia. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has escalated into a broad, dangerous conflict with NATO and the West. The goal of U.S. policy should be to prevent major war, and deterrence will require a much greater capacity to produce artillery shells, other weapons, and air defense systems to be shared with Ukraine and Taiwan. We also need to build more long-range missiles, ships, and submarines to keep the upper hand in a great power war. In 1940, the cost of failing to stop the fascist powers early was ghastly, including 60 million dead. Containing and deterring Russia and China will not be easy or cheap, but the alternative could be much worse. How blasts damage veterans. We owe our service members better, said Daniel S. Johnson. An autopsy report on Army reservist Robert Card, who killed 18 people in Maine last October, found that he had profound brain damage. Card was a grenade instructor and may have been exposed to more than 10,000 blasts. In the military, brain injuries can occur in both training and combat as the result of proximity to artillery fire, hand grenades, tank weapons, and frequent explosions. Research has shown that blasts cause shock waves that injure brain tissue, creating crippling levels of anxiety and depression. Suicide rates for service members with traumatic brain injuries are nearly triple the national average. We don't know how Card's brain damage affected his behavior, but he heard voices and threatened people, leading to a stay in a psychiatric hospital, where he wasn't assessed for a brain injury. Brain injuries aren't always readily apparent, and many remain invisible wounds that fester for decades. The military should recognize exposure to blast as an occupational health hazard, equip service men and women with blast gauges that track their exposure over time, and ensure guaranteed specialized brain care. Otherwise, the hidden enemy will keep killing members of the military. This column comes from Columbia. The Latin nostalgia for a Soviet ally. Why won't Latin America help Ukraine repel the Russian invaders? Asked Luis Eduardo Gutierrez. While Western governments are busy shipping weapons to Kyiv, Latin America's leftist leaders have stayed out of it, refusing to offer even verbal support for the Ukrainian cause. The reason may lie in this region's residual gratitude for Soviet backing of leftist movements here during the Cold War. Russia is the symbolic heir of the great power that supported the communists and guerrillas, while the U.S. is still condemned for having sided with right-wing dictators and their death squads. Keen to prolong this Soviet influence in their countries of the global South, Russia has flooded the region with propaganda. Russian outlets RT and Sputnik are both carried on the Venezuelan broadcaster Telesur, reaching millions of viewers across Latin America with messages promoting Russia as an iconoclastic force for a multipolar New World Order. So while it's not fair to say that Latin American leaders full-throatedly support Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it is true that they have not been able to choose between their rejection of the United States and their rejection of the use of violence. Instead, they have opted for silence. I accidentally skipped over the briefing, so we'll pick that up now. AI goes to war. Artificial intelligence is reshaping military strategy and weaponry. Could autonomous killing machines be next? How are militaries deploying AI? Some countries are employing the technology to speed up decision-making, giving commanders an edge in combat. In its war in Gaza, Israel has relied on machine learning system called the Gospel that is thought to crunch vast quantities of data from satellites, radars, drones, and other sources to identify Hamas targets, from rocket launchers to command posts to individual fighters. Basically, Gospel imitates what a group of intelligence officers used to do in the past, said Tal Mimran, an Israeli cybersecurity expert. Gospel can suggest 200 targets in about 10 days, a rate 50 times faster than that of its human counterparts. AI has a growing physical presence on the battlefield, with autonomous combat devices, basically fighting robots, starting to proliferate across air, land, and sea. For now, human controllers make the final decision about what and when to strike, but some experts believe it's only a matter of time before robots are making deadly battlefield decisions or AI command systems are giving troops direct fighting orders. The advantage in war will go to those who no longer see the world like humans. Army research officials Tom Hawkins and Alexander Kott wrote in 2022, "We can now be targeted by something relentless, a thing that does not sleep." Is the U.S. using the technology? The Pentagon, which requested $3 billion for AI-related projects in its most recent budget submission, is rushing to develop autonomous weaponry and AI-powered battlefield management systems. It has already deployed miniature surveillance drones with a degree of autonomy and a Gospel-like system called Project Maven that has been used to locate Houthi rocket launchers in Yemen and to narrow targets for strikes on Iran-backed militias in Iraq and Syria. That's just the beginning of the Pentagon's AI ambitions. Its Replicator program aims to build thousands of relatively inexpensive self-guided combat devices, aircraft, ground vehicles, and sea vessels and submarines that could identify and swarm targets autonomously. That program is intended to offset China's numerical advantage in warships, aircraft, and troops should Beijing decide to invade Taiwan, a U.S. ally. "We'll counter the Chinese military's mass with a mass of our own," U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks said last year. "But ours will be harder to plan for, harder to hit, harder to beat." That program is still in its early stages, but others, such as the Air Force's plan to deploy 1,000 so-called collaborative combat aircraft, are further along. How will those aircraft be used? They're AI-powered drones that fly alongside piloted aircraft. These robotic wingmen cost as little as $3 million apiece. A single F-35 jet cost $80 million and could zoom ahead to conduct high-risk surveillance or attack enemy air defenses in missions considered too dangerous for humans. Fighter pilots are currently making test runs alongside an experimental aircraft, the XQ-58A Valkyrie, at Elgin Air Force Base in Florida. "It's a very strange feeling," said Major Ross Elder. "I'm flying off the wing of something that's making its own decisions, and it's not a human brain." Similar machines are appearing in the seas. Next year, the Australian Navy will take delivery of 3 unmanned AI-powered submarines called Ghost Sharks. Those school bus-sized craft cost $15 million apiece, less than 0.1% of the price tag of the human-operated nuclear subs Australia has on order, and can be built quickly and descend much deeper and linger underwater for longer than traditional manned subs. But the use of such technology in war carries a huge amount of legal, ethical, and moral implications, said U.S. Army General Mark Milley, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What are the concerns? Some experts worry that AI's ability to analyze massive amounts of information, surveillance data, social media posts, even shopping habits, could result in these weapons being used to target specific ethnicities or other population groups. Drone swarms, which are being developed by China as well as the U.S., could wipe out, say, all males between 12 and 60 in a city, said Stuart Russell, a computer scientist at the University of California, Berkeley. Unlike nuclear weapons, they leave no radioactive crater, and they keep all the valuable physical assets intact. There's also the fear that autonomous weapons will eventually be allowed to make decisions on when and what to attack, a power over life and death that until now has rested with humans. And while AI is smart, it's not perfect. AI chatbots frequently make up or hallucinate non-existent facts, books, and people, leading some scientists to worry that AI weapons or command systems might hallucinate legitimate targets with fatal consequences. Will AI be allowed to make kill decisions? The U.S. says its AI-driven weapon systems will not be allowed to take lethal action independently. It's not Terminator, said 18th Airborne Corps Colonel Joseph O'Callaghan, who is overseeing the testing of Project Maven. But in a possible sign of what's next, the U.S., Russia, Israel, and others have argued at the United Nations that human control of autonomous weapons is not required by international law. Meanwhile, China has called for narrow legal limits on autonomous weapons that arms control advocates say are effectively meaningless. In an AI arms race that could decide the global balance of power, no nation is willing to commit to binding agreements that might cede advantage to a less constrained foe. Individual decisions versus not doing individual decisions is the difference between winning and losing, U.S. Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall said, and you're not going to lose. And the last word, our feature article, the squatter hunter. Handyman Flash Shelton helps California homeowners boot squatters from their property, said Jack Fleming in the Los Angeles Times. How? By moving in with the trespassers. On a winter morning in Woodland Hills, the squatter hunter slowly approaches a posh two-story home dressed in all black, armed with a Glock 26 pistol, stun gun, pepper spray, and a baton. His body camera is on. His two-man squad lurks behind him. They've spent 4 days in surveillance, learning the habits of the man squatting inside. They've waited for him to leave, but he never does. So they knock on the front door, and when the occupant opens it, they barge inside. Their plan? Live with the squatter. Dirty the bathroom. Take the best spot on the couch. Commandeer the TV remote. Blast music. Drink his coffee. Eat his Cheetos. Out-squat him. And film it all for YouTube. As the body camera footage shows, the team starts installing ring cameras throughout the home to document every interaction. The squatter hunter, Flash Shelton, hands the man a lease with Shelton's name on it. "You're an intruder in my house now," he says. Shelton explains that the man is there illegally, and the team is not going anywhere until he leaves. The squatter was out before they could even share breakfast together. For homeowners in Southern California and beyond, run-ins with squatters can be a nightmare both emotionally and financially. For the squatter hunter, it's just another day on the job. What started as a viral YouTube video has grown into a one-of-a-kind vigilante-style service, helping homeowners boot trespassers from their property. His motto, if they can take a house, I can take a house. Shelton, a California native, understands what drives some people to squat. He said he grew up practically homeless, moving every time the rent was due. At 16, he started a handyman business, and in 2009, he established the United Handyman Association, a trade organization that lobbies for handyman rights. Along the way, Shelton, 56, also worked as a bouncer, where he learned how to handle situations that could turn violent. I took the same de-escalation course law enforcement would take, he said. Shelton's first experience with a squatter was in 2019. Shelton's father had died 2 years prior, and his mother moved in with him while they put her Northern California home on the market. A woman reached out about renting it, offering repairs for free rent, since she had no money. But Shelton declined. But while the home was unoccupied, the woman broke in through the back door and moved in, furniture and all, Shelton said. He started receiving calls from real estate agents planning to show the house to prospective buyers, saying they couldn't access it because people were living inside. He called the local sheriff's department, but according to Shelton, they said they couldn't enter the house since it appeared to be occupied. Hearing nightmares about the lengthy and arduous process of dragging out an eviction in court, Shelton got creative. He had his mom write up a lease, making him the official tenant of the home. That way, he could legally enter the property. If they're the squatter, they have rights. So if I become the squatter on a squatter, I should have rights, he said. He drove 10 hours from the San Fernando Valley and slept in his Jeep outside the home, waiting for her to leave in the morning. When she did, he went inside and installed Ring cameras throughout the property. When she returned, he explained that he was the new tenant and that she needed to move all her stuff out. Since he was now in possession of the property, he said if she returned, he would call the police for trespassing. She left by the end of the day. Shelton recorded the entire encounter and published a recap on YouTube titled, How I Removed Squatters in Less Than a Day. The video went viral, racking up millions of views and thousands of comments. Shelton saw an opportunity. I just simplified it. There's so many people asking me why we haven't been doing this all along, he said. I was just fighting for my mom in the beginning, but now I've reinvented myself. And so, the Squatter Hunter was born. Shelton started a website where he offers his services, and over the last year he has conducted hundreds of Zoom consultations, talking homeowners through their squatter problems and coaching them on potential strategies. Business is booming. He consults for free but requires clients to donate $150 to GoFundMe advocating for squatter law change. So far, he's raised nearly $9,000. For clients with bigger problems, Shelton offers to remove the squatter personally, either by himself or with a team he assembles. Over the past few months, he said, he has handled about 10 jobs in California and Nevada. The minimum price for a job is around $5,000. There is no maximum. Sometimes it takes 3 to 4 hours. Sometimes it takes weeks. It can be costly, but Shelton says he's encountered homeowners who've already sunk $100,000 into their efforts to remove a squatter through the legal system and made no progress. I don't tell them what I'm doing or how I'm doing it. I just tell them to make me a leaseholder, and I handle the rest, he said. Squatters aren't created in a vacuum. More often than not, they're the product of a brutal California housing market in which rents skyrocket and affordable housing disappears. In Los Angeles, the median rent is $2,750, well above the national median of $2,045, according to Zillow. Soaring home values, especially since the pandemic, have contributed to a widening wealth gap in Southern California, leaving many renters in desperate financial situations. But there's a big difference between tenants, even ones who stopped paying rent a long time ago, and squatters. A tenant is someone who was invited onto a property with consent, said Mark Martinez, a tenant rights attorney. That consent can be as formal as a written lease or as casual as a verbal agreement. Even if a tenant stops paying rent, they still have protections. For example, Elizabeth Hirschhorn, the woman who stayed in a luxury Airbnb in Brentwood for 570 days rent-free, in a story that made national news, was technically a tenant. Even though she stopped paying rent, she initially had an agreement to move in. A squatter is essentially a trespasser, Martinez said, someone who goes into a property without permission and stays there. Besides adverse possession, a rarely seen process in which a person can obtain a property after openly living there and paying property taxes for 5 years, there are no true squatters' rights, Martinez said. Trespassing is illegal, and squatters cannot legally live in a home. Still, they are innocent until proven guilty, and homeowners can't simply go in and drag them out of the home, or else they expose themselves to a potential lawsuit for harassment or assault. Shelton said many homeowners he consults will claim that police aren't able to remove squatters because they have no proof of when exactly the squatter entered the home and how long they've been there. Shelton has to be selective with the cases he takes. First, he deals only with squatters, never tenants, and takes on cases only where nothing has been filed in court so that there's no proof that the squatter is living in the home. If a judge has already given them tenant rights, his hands are tied on what he's legally allowed to do. Then he visits the local law enforcement office and explains what he's doing. That way, if there's a hostile situation, police officers know his specific plans and intentions. After that, he works with the homeowner to write up a lease declaring him the tenant and records himself signing it. If he ever goes to court, he'll have proof that the home belongs to him. The fact that he's doing the work and not the homeowner is part of Shelton's legal calculus. According to Martinez, California law prohibits self-help evictions in which landlords try to remove a squatter themselves. It's one of four things he lists on his website for landlords to avoid when trying to evict a tenant. No self-help evictions, no retaliation against the tenant, no discrimination, and no harassment. He adds that a homeowner who hires Shelton might have vicarious liability. They didn't kick the squatter out themselves, but someone they hired did. Once the lease is signed, he turns into a private investigator, researching everything he can about the squatter. Name, age, background check, criminal history, anything he can use when he finally confronts them. He interviews neighbors to learn the squatter's habits and stakes out the house for days to see when they leave and when they return. Shelton sometimes works solo, and if he does need help, he has a strict screening process for those who want to join an operation. Most guys I talk to have beer muscles and want to rip a squatter right out of the house. I need someone who can stand there and keep their mouth shut, he said. If he brings in someone who whips out a weapon and hurts someone, he could potentially be liable, he said. Although every case is different, there's generally an easy way and a hard way to remove a squatter. The easy way. Wait for the squatter to leave the home and secure possession of the property while they're gone. Change the locks and install security cameras. Now they're fighting to get back in instead of the homeowner fighting to get them out, he said. The situations are tense, but he said he stays calm. The de-escalation training helps. I know these people didn't wake up with the intention to ruin my day. Squatters aren't attacking me or my family. They're just taking advantage of a system, he said. The last thing I want to do is aggravate a situation that could be handled civilly, and part of that is being nice. The hard way, squatting with the squatter. If I can't get them off the property, I'll move in with them, he said. I walk in, sit on the couch, pour a bowl of cereal, and say, Lucy, I'm home. He hands the squatter a copy of the lease and explains that he's not going anywhere, and he's there to make their living situation miserable and turn it into a reality show with cameras everywhere. They're typically out by the end of the day. To help persuade squatters to leave, he offers them a deal. If they go peacefully, he'll keep their identity a secret. Most squatters accept. For those who don't, he uploads their pictures onto his website and their interaction onto YouTube and Instagram. He's currently building a database of confirmed squatters so landlords can avoid renting to them in the future. One YouTube video details a confrontation with Adam Fleischman, the former chief executive of the restaurant chain Umami Burger. In the video, Fleischman claims he had a verbal agreement to live in a Hollywood Hills home, giving him rights as a tenant, but that he didn't have to pay rent. In another, Shelton sneaks up on a woman entering a Culver City home through a window. "What do you have to say for yourself?" he asks. She doesn't take the bait, instead responding with an onslaught of curses. Shelton, a single father with five kids, two living at home, doesn't want to hunt squatters forever, but demand has been overwhelming. The end game is policy change. His GoFundMe advocates for legislation that would expand law enforcement's ability to remove squatters and also to make it easier for judges to order squatters to pay restitution. "The whole system needs to change," he said. "I want my name on a bill." This story was first published in the Los Angeles Times. We're on the Talking Points page. Start with the article, "Abortion, Still a Winning Issue for Democrats?" No sitting president or vice president had ever visited an abortion clinic before Kamala Harris did so last week, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. "That fact tells you pretty much everything you need to know about how the overturning of Roe v. Wade by the Donald Trump stacked Supreme Court has transformed the political landscape." Speaking at a Planned Parenthood clinic in St. Paul, Minnesota, Vice President Harris praised staff there for providing health care in a safe place and decried anti-abortion extremists. "It's a long way from the not-so-distant days when Democrats worried about alienating moderates with abortion talk, saying only that the procedure should be safe, legal, and rare. But with Republicans rushing to fill the post-Roe vacuum with draconian restrictions on reproductive rights, and voters even in red states consistently passing ballot measures to protect abortion access, the Biden-Harris campaign knows it can only benefit by reminding Americans how Trump took away women's freedom to control their own bodies." "It's one thing to talk about reproductive rights," said Ingrid Jacque in USA Today. "It's another to pose with abortionists and celebrate the ending of a human life's belonging, turning tragedy into gross campaign fodder. If the Biden administration thinks it can whip independents and moderates into a frenzy on this issue, it hasn't been paying attention," said Caitlin Buss in the Detroit News. The share of voters who rated abortion as their top issue dropped from about 1 in 4 in 2022 to 1 in 8 this month. Voters, men and women, are instead more focused on inflation and the border, areas where Biden gets low marks. The extreme abortion activism he has farmed out to Harris stinks of desperation. Non-white voters shifting toward the GOP? With the November elections looming, Democrats face a massive vulnerability, said Russell Contreras in Axios. They are losing black and Hispanic voters. For decades, non-white voters have been one of the most loyal parts of the Democratic coalition. But that's rapidly changing. A recent New York Times poll found that non-white Americans who backed President Biden by a margin of nearly 50 percentage points in 2020 now favor him over Donald Trump by just 12 points, 56% to 44%. Among Hispanic voters, Trump now actually leads, 46 to 40. In Gallup polling, the share of Latinos who consider themselves Democrats dropped from 57% to 47% from 2020 to 2023. It's a foreboding shift for Democrats, who until recently had reason to believe rising numbers of Hispanic voters would give them a solid majority for decades. This shift may mystify progressives consumed with identity politics, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial, but it's not surprising. The Biden economy has benefited white professionals with stock portfolios, but minorities have been battered by the highest food prices in 30 years and skyrocketing rents and mortgages. Many black voters favor tough crime policies, and many Latino citizens competing for jobs want a secure border, not Biden's catch-and-release disaster. Party identities have changed, said John Bird Murdoch in the Financial Times. The GOP has become the home of working-class voters of all races rather than the party of wealthy country club elites. And many black and Hispanics are churchgoers with traditional values on gender, sex, and religion. The shift among Latino voters defies a simple explanation, said Jennifer Medina and Ruth Igelnick in the New York Times. Latinos are a large and diverse group, and differences across regions, generations, and economics all play a role. Trump has gained support among evangelical Latinos and among young second-generation Latinos inclined to vote like their white peers. Most upwardly mobile Latinos see Trump as a blunt businessman and don't consider themselves the target of his incendiary rhetoric about migrants. Some strategists believe that polls are missing Latino citizens with limited English and that in the end, Trump will drive Hispanic voters back to Biden. But with Latinos now accounting for 15% of eligible U.S. voters, their votes may be pivotal. In November and beyond, neither party can win with white voters alone. And some of the short notes. Texas has spent roughly $150 million over the past 2 years to bus more than 100,000 migrants from the state to self-declared sanctuary cities such as Chicago, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Despite early promises from Governor Greg Abbott that private donations would cover the cost of busing, more than 99.5% of it has been borne by taxpayers. School hate crimes against LGBTQ plus students more than doubled from an annual average of 108 from 2015 to 2019 to 232 in 2021 and 2022, according to FBI data. In states that have passed laws or policies curbing LGBTQ plus student rights and education, school hate crimes more than quadrupled over the same period. The Environmental Protection Agency this week finalized a ban on the only type of asbestos still used in the U.S., more than three decades after a federal judge blocked the agency's first attempt to rid the nation of the carcinogenic material mineral. The new ban applies to chrysotile asbestos, which is used in roofing materials, brake pads, and gaskets. Some 40,000 U.S. deaths annually are linked to asbestos exposure. Unintentional shootings by children killed at least 157 people last year and wounded 270 more, according to the gun safety group Everytown. About half of the 411 shootings, the highest number since Everytown began tracking such incidents in 2015, involved children who shot themselves. In the other half, someone else was wounded or killed, typically another child. On the poll watch, 7.6% of U.S. adults identified as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer in 2023, an all-time high. 2.3% of baby boomers identify as LGBTQ, while 22.3% of Gen Zers do. 60% of voters are somewhat or very comfortable with someone older than 80 serving as president, but 62% aren't comfortable with octogenarians performing surgery, and 60% aren't comfortable with airline pilots of that age. Got time for two quotes. Maya Angelou says, "People will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel." And for all you NC State basketball fans, quote from Rudyard Kipling. He says, "The strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.